Thank you, Ramesh. And he's already given me permission to go a little over time. So if you're bound to a schedule, it won't hurt my feelings if you get up and leave. But if you're not bound to a schedule, it will hurt my feelings. This is a little bit, perhaps one of the more unusual papers that I've ever presented to Beltwide. It really came from the research I was doing to write this paper that was just published in Journal of Cotton Science on the history of cotton breeding genetics at the University of Arkansas. While doing research on that for that paper, I was really just overwhelmed by this man, Jacob Ware. I knew of him, but as I read experimentation bulletins and annual reports, it really just kind of blew me away of the magnitude and significance of his career. And, to a large extent, I think he's probably been forgotten. I suspect a lot of you have seen his name in literature, but perhaps not really realize the significance. So what I would like to do, two things today, is one is simply review the career of Dr. Ware, and then contrast his program to our current program. To me, that was a very interesting aspect as I was putting this together, just to see how it compared then what he did to today. Well, Jacob Osborne Ware was born in 1888 in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. He got his B.S. and M.S. at North Carolina State University, Ph.D. from Cornell. He married Melba Frances French, and they had one daughter, Patricia. And I don't know if she's still alive or not, but she was born in about 1930. His career, he was on faculty at the University of Arkansas from 1920 to 1934. And then he went with USDA and became senior cotton agronomist, USDA Beltsville, from 1934 to 1950. When 1950 he returned to Fayetteville with a joint appointment with USDA until his retirement in 1958. And then he was given emeritus status until his death in 1977. Now, during that time when he was at Beltsville, I looked at a 1940 census and found that this is where he lived. He rented an apartment in apartment 131 at 4000 Cathedral Avenue Northwest. This building was built in 1931 and it still exists today. By the way, on the internet, there's a condominium up on the sixth floor, one bedroom, one bath condominium is for sale for $300,000 now. Quite a bit more than the rent he paid back in 1940. It's also interesting in that census it gives people's, his neighbors were mostly like a lieutenant colonel and high military officers that I'm sure worked in Washington, D.C., and also a vice president of a little company. All of them had salaries about $5,000-$6,000, so that's kind of gives you a feel for what life was like in 1940. There was cotton breeding occurring at the University of Arkansas prior to J.O. York, prior to 1920. 1908, there's an annual report noted that their careful selection was made from cotton as well as other crops, but they don't indicate who did it. So I don't know if they actually had a breeder or not. From 12 to 15, W.C. Laster and M.S. Baker were named as breeders. Laster then left and went to Extension, and Baker just retired. I don't know what happened to him, or resigned. From 16 to 19, W. Ayers was the breeder. He left then, went to Stoneville, Mississippi, to work on long staple cotton. I don't know what happened to that. 1920-21, E.A. Dotson. He is really pretty significant. He overlapped some with Ware. He developed a method for estimating lint frequency, which is quite interesting. And then he also documented variation associated with 7 years of pedigree selection from one thrice plant. And he indicated that perhaps environment had an effect on this, the different breeders, but I suspect there was quite a bit of unintentional outcrossing. Most of the selection that these early breeders did, most of the work they did, was just simply selections from existing varieties rather than there was some crossing, but there's not much evidence of any kind of individual plant, progeny row type of things like we do today. To really understand Dr. Ware's career, I think you have to look at some of the cotton statistics in Arkansas. I could not find comparable statistics prior to 1927. So this shows 1927 through when he retired in 1958. The blue line on top indicates the acreage. And it's really quite remarkable. In 1930, there was over 3.5 million acres of cotton in Arkansas. Now, if you divide that by the land area of Arkansas, it's a little over 10% of the land area, total land area of the state, was planted in cotton. That, from that record high, it decreased, the number of acreage decreased through much of his career. The red line indicates the yield per acre, and it was also, in 1930, it was record high acreage. It was also a record low yield of 119 pounds per acre, less than 10% of what our state average is today. I'm sure, and you can see, that very low acreage was associated with the high number of acres that was planted. It was planted on probably land that should not have been planted in cotton. But also, I found a record that in northeast Arkansas in 1930, there were 71 consecutive rainless days, and the record all-time temperature of 113 degrees was measured during that summer. So there were some environmental factors in that very low yield. Well, acreage decreased, yield per acre increased, and I think it was a high in 1955 of 545 during this time span. On the lower, you see that with this decreased acreage, increased yield per acre, production, that green line, stayed, there was some fluctuation, but fairly level over that whole time. And then the blue line indicates, it is significant. The high in production was 1948 of 1.982 million bales. Now, that's the reason that's significant is that's the year I was born in Arkansas, so I can take some credit for that production. Okay, the blue line indicates what happened in price. It was at a record low of a little over 5 cents a pound in 1931, and then it increased to a high of about almost 40 cents in 1950. You see at the bottom, Agriculture Adjustment Acts of 1933 and 1938 were very much involved with the acreage associated with cotton. Well, during that time span, Arkansas production started off mule drawing equipment. Jesse, your first slide was very appropriate. I should have borrowed that from you. Tractor use had increased after World War II, but during much of his career, it was mule drawing equipment. They planted fuzzy seed. Now, the thing that really struck me, can you imagine packaging fuzzy seed in some type of a container or envelope or some type of container, then hand dribbling it with a mule drawn planter? It's phenomenal. I don't know how they did it. They plant with fuzzy seed. You always plant a lot more seed than you wanted, then get stands and thin them by hand, by hoeing. Fertilizers were limited, and much of Arkansas didn't need fertilizer. It was new ground, and they had excess growth anyway. Weed control was hand chopping, cultivation, mechanical weed control, insect and disease control were limited. Basically, no irrigation. There was probably some introduced in the 1950s, but before that, it was all non-irrigated, no plant growth regulators or defoliants, and harvest was essentially all by hand with multiple pickings. Now, right toward the end of his career, there is a bulletin publication he released and talking about developing varieties that would be particularly adapted for machine picking. So he kind of gapped into that area. So to summarize, it was a very labor intensive with limited pest control. Now, in terms of variety development highlights, he developed all the Arkansas Rowden varieties. Rowden 40 was probably the most successful one. In the early 1930s, it made up about 50% of Arkansas acreage, which is about 1.5 million acres just in the state of Arkansas, as well as being planted in some of the neighboring states. There were several Arkansas Kayla lines, other Rowden lines. In the seed collection, I found a big bowl Rowden, and I suspect I could find no documentation of him releasing the variety. If you ever want to see something interesting, that thing's got a green bowl about like a grapefruit. No, not quite that. A small grapefruit. It's a monstrous large bowl, hence the name Big Bowl. There are other lines in annual reports, but it was hard to determine whether they had been released as varieties or not. Several Thrice lines, Acadia lines, Rowden lines, Arkansas Express, and Lone Star, Dixie, and Sweepstakes. So all of these were in his annual reports. A second area of work that he did was in variety testing, and he did that from 1920 in Arkansas, from 1920 to 1934, then again in the early 1950s. And I took out from a bulletin that was published in 1925 that talks about that covers the 1923 and 24 test as an example. It was done at four locations. All of these were on farm. There were no branch stations in Arkansas at that time. The four locations are Scott, which is close to Little Rock, Burdette, which is in northeast Arkansas, very close to where I live. Lake Village is southeast, kind of across from Stoneville or Greenville. Holman is in southwest, close to Texarkana. So a lot of miles, 200 to 300 miles from Fayetteville, where he was located. In 1923, the number of entries ranged from 36 to 51 with 3 to 10 replications. 1924, all of them, 4 replications, but number of entries ranged from 46 to 91. The data he reported is number of plants, which is kind of curious since they hand thinned them. I don't know how you would have much difference in number of plants after you hand thinned. Then first pick seed cotton yield, total seed cotton yield, percent lint, and all was done with 100 bowl samples. And much of these tests, they would sample every rep. Total lint yield, total seed yield, bows per pound, and staple length. Tremendous, and recall, this is all hand-planted with fuzzy seed and all hand-picked. I'm just blown away when you start thinking about the amount of labor and then not to even have an experiment station staff to be able to coordinate that. It's a tremendous amount of work. He also did a great deal of basic studies and inheritance and relationship, and the citations of these are in the paper. Red leaf color, leaf shape, fiber length percentage, high and low protein seed, sparse, naked seed. Then other studies did considerable amount on plant spacing, and that was primarily looking to see how they could get more earliness in order to escape the boll weevil. That was the primary motivation of those studies. Fusarium wilt, did with a pathologist, and he did some early work on boll weevil with Dwight Isley, an entomologist. And interesting, they determined that red leaf cotton, that boll weevils preferred green leaf over red leaf cotton. And Waddle had suggested this was probably the first incident of host plant resistance to insects ever reported, perhaps in any crop. In addition to variety development and variety testing, he did extensive reviews of U.S. Cotton breeding in 1937 in the USDA yearbook. There's a chapter, if you haven't seen, it's very interesting. 1952, he published a paper through a departmental publication. Unfortunately, it's not very widely available, but a lot of the information from that is in this bulletin that is available, that bulletin 527. And in there, he puts together the pedigrees going into Stoneville and Delta Pine cottons, which Gerald ended up publishing including in my paper, Journal of Cotton Science. But also, I thought it was very interesting. He developed a key that could be used to identify the different varieties that were grown in Arkansas at that time. And illustrating is very, very fascinating. He co-authored a cotton reference book you may be familiar with. This was with H.B. Brown, which I think he was at LSU, wasn't he, Gerald? Yeah. So he was a cotton breeding giant. He was involved with variety testing, variety development, variety testing, inheritance and relationship studies, extensive reviews of U.S. cotton breeding, co-author of a cotton reference book. He was a USDA ARS administrative role, and in that role, in his obituary, it noted that he was responsible for establishing national cotton variety testing. Now, I assume that's the same thing we're still working with today, the NCVT testing. So while he was with the USDA, apparently he was the one to establish that. Phil Miller in 1998, that was the 50th anniversary of our Cotton Improvement Conference. Phil And in his paper, he notes Ware as being a key early leader. So I think that's a good description of it. Now, the second part, the other thing I wanted to accomplish today is kind of compare his program to our current program. Some of the similarities: campus is still 200 to 300 miles away from the major cotton-growing areas of the state. We still work with the same plant. The development and genetics of that plant is essentially the same. Obviously, we made some changes. Similar pests, except boll weevil's out. Now, verticillium wilt and nematodes are greater pests, greater importance than they were at his time. His breeding objectives are very similar, and his breeding methods, to a large extent, numbers and generations, are very similar. In 1929, in his annual report, he included this paragraph talking about some of his procedures, and I've gone through and underlined selection criteria. And from individual plants, he looked for freedom from disease, productivity, size of boll, desirable staple, ease of picking, storm resistance, and other observable qualities. Then after they were harvested, he looked at percent lint and character and length of staple. When he got into progeny rows, he included yield, size of boll, size of seed, lint index, the lint percentage, and the quality of the lint. Of the things he's looking at, probably size of boll and ease of picking are the only two that we don't really pay much attention to today. Now, in terms of numbers, he indicated that he did about 1,000 individual plants per year. He selected these down to about 250, I assume, was based upon lint percentage and on the staple length. About a fourth of these, those progeny rows would be harvested, or about 60 of them, and then about half of those would have gone into newest strains test. And what's remarkable then, in advanced strains test, he said it was much larger than his variety test. That variety test was monstrous. It included strains from Arkansas Experiment Station, other Ag Experiment Station, public breeders, and checks. I put the numbers that are associated with my program on the right. It's kind of a comparison. It's somewhat similar. Some of the same terminology is used. Well, today's advantages, we certainly have a greater understanding of genetics and related disciplines than he did. This was early after the rediscovery of Mendel's laws. Improved production practices, and I think particularly irrigation. Essentially, none of his plots were probably ever irrigated, and that's added a great deal of precision to our testing. Specialized equipment for packaging seed, planting plots, harvesting plots, ginning, weighing. Thank the Lord for electronic balances. If you've ever tried to weigh things without electronic balances, then these weigh systems that we have now. Fiber quality analysis greatly increased, testing procedures, statistics, and regional tests available to us to evaluate lines. Formal release and record of varieties give us a lot better idea of what to do and what to use. Transportation, he was probably using a T-model without air conditioning and sometimes without roads. Travel and movement of samples, and perhaps the biggest change is our computer, being data handling, word processing, communication. Also, computers are in much of our equipment. So we have a number of advantages today. We have some disadvantages. Today, we have our traits are more complex. Then he looked at plant color, some of these very easy things to evaluate and measure. Now we're working with more quantitative traits and much more complex. There's less state support. Simple facts, percent of voters associated with agriculture has greatly declined, and therefore agriculture, as you well know, in Arkansas, and I suspect in your state, is not as well supported as it was. I doubt if he ever wrote a grant proposal, and now we spent how much of our time is spent chasing a few dollars. We have the disadvantage of restrictions on labor. We have increased costs. Plus, we don't have the skilled labor. And what I'm calling skilled labor is hand pickers. When 10% of your state was in cotton, you had a lot of people who knew how to pick cotton. Now, those folks are not there anymore. Or a few of us are. Not many of us are. Fourthly, he increased regulation concerning materials and material germplasm exchange. We get in all kinds of legal issues when we try to make a cross today if we don't have some type of documentation to make everybody, our lawyers, happy. Five, diminished public relations. There's competing sources of information. A limited role of public varieties. I don't know anywhere where 50% of the state is planted in a public variety anymore. And finally, increased administrative demands, reports, evaluations, publish or perish, paperwork. All of us have dealt with that. So, cotton breeding, is it easier then or now? I thought about this for a while, and I decided I would not like to go back to breeding cotton when I didn't have a plot picker and didn't have a computer and had and didn't have some of the conveniences and the air-conditioned vehicle and some the conveniences that we have today. So I applaud him for what he accomplished, particularly in the time that he did it. So, final thing, three breeders with the longest tenure at the University of Arkansas include J.O. Ware, 38 years of cotton breeding, 22 of them at U of A. Brad Waddle, 34 years, all at the U of A, and that last person, myself, 41 years of breeding, 31 of those at the U of A. So a total of 113 years of cotton breeding, 87 of those at the University of Arkansas. And I think that's a very nice lineage. Like I said, it's written, and there's a nice link between that because Dr. Ware, when Dr. Waddle was hired in 1951, he ended up sharing an office with Dr. Waddle really until his death, even after he retired in emeritus status. Now, then Dr. Waddle became, he was my major professor starting in 1970 on my master's degree. So I shouldn't have been surprised that the terminology and things that Ware done is still present in my program today. I inherited it, in a sense, through these two men, from Ware through Waddle. I had occasion when I was working on my master's degree that I met Dr. Ware. He happened to be in Dr. Waddle in their office one day when I went in. Unfortunately, the only picture I have of that is up here in my brain. I would give anything. I wish I had a picture of it. Plus, I also wish I had knew what I know now to be able to have a conversation with him. Finally, Dr. Ware was not the first cotton breeder at the University of Arkansas, but he was the first to establish a legacy that still remains today. Arkansas and the cotton industry are heavily indebted to these early breeders and researchers like Dr. Ware, who paved the way for us. Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Fred Borland?
Yes, Roy. Yeah, I did not see any evidence of graduate students. All of his publications were with other project leaders, other disciplines. Graduate students probably began training. Probably began. I know it began in the 1950s, probably with Waddle, sometime about that time. I was not the first one, so that's. That's what you were thinking, wasn't it? I was with Waddle from 70 to 73, 1970 to 73. Don.
Brad, you promised you'll work 10 more years, but after then, what happens to this century of work?
That's a good question. If I look at what has happened with other project leaders, very successful programs at the University of Arkansas, I fear that it would not exist. Derek Oosterhaus, can you find a more successful cotton physiology program? He retired a couple of years ago, and that program does not exist anymore. I would hope that it will continue, but if I retired when cotton is down, acreage is down, I know it wouldn't be replaced. With cotton acreage coming back, it's a better chance. Is that it? So I don't know. But we continue through our system to be asked to do more with less and cover more bases, and that's unfortunate. Any other questions? Thank you for your attention. This was a fun project. Like I said, it's probably the most unusual paper. I didn't present any data, did I? Essentially none. But it was ended up being kind of a labor of love going through these old publications. Took way more time than I should have spent on it. But anyway, thank you.